and inside I press and condense it. I make an accumulated cluster of plastic bags that ends up creating this image that you see.
Sura's exhibition is due to open in Sao Paulo in the coming months. His previous works were also aimed at raising awareness about the environment. He has created several giant installations in public places, mostly along polluted rivers.
A science professor has released spectacular drone footage of lava streaming from an Icelandic volcano. Sørensen Johnson flew a drone over the volcano 2 months after it started erupting. He captured close-up shots of lava bubbling in its crater in the southwest of Iceland's capital. The volcanologists say that they have no idea how long this eruption will continue, adding that magma could flow for years. Iceland is home to dozens of active volcanoes. Volcanic landscapes have turned into a tourist attraction in the Scandinavian country. Two Russian cosmonauts have conducted spacewalk outside the International Space Station to prepare an old docking module for disposal. The duo spent more than 7 hours outside the ISS to wrap up preparations for the eventual disposal of the Pris docking compartment. According to NASA officials, the Russian cargo freighter will remove the two-decade-old module from the orbiting laboratory later this summer. Both the cargo ship and a Pris will burn up in the atmosphere above the Pacific Ocean. The orbiting Pris will clear the way for the arrival of a new Russian multipurpose laboratory module named Nuka, meaning science in Russian. Nuka is scheduled to launch on July the 15th this year. Wednesday's operation was the sixth spacewalk in 2021 in support of the Space Station Assembly, maintenance and upgrades.
A rare albino baby elephant that was rescued from poachers in South Africa has found a new home with a welcoming herd. The calf, named Han Yi Sa, was caught in a snare in the Kruger National Park when she was only 4 months old. She suffered several nasty wounds, including one to her mouth. Han Yi Sa remained trapped in the snare for 4 days before being rescued and taken to a shelter, especially built for elephants, northeast of Johannesburg. All the other elephants there are orphans too.
Each female that we had has a baby. So except for them, all of the others are orphaned. And I think that is part of the reason why they accept these orphans, because they know how it feels, you know, and they become actually, you know, the mother figures for them.
The calf has learned to adapt to the new life. She lies under the shadow cast by bigger elephants to protect herself from getting sunburnt. The shelter says if the herd grows too big for the area, she and other elephants will be released into the wild.
Chinese archaeologists have unearthed a rare 3,000-year-old bronze figure from a site they have been excavating for months in Sichuan province. The 1.5-meter figure deemed one of China's most famous archaeological discoveries. It consists of two parts. The upper part is 55 centimeters high with a zoon, a vessel used in ancient times, on top of the head. The lower part is 60 centimeters in size with kneeling posture. Similar findings in the past were just 20 centimeters in their heights. The bronze figure was discovered under massive ivory objects. So far, over 500 objects, including ivory, bronze, gold, and jade ware, have been found from six sacrificial pits of the Sanjiangdu ruins. A Chinese man becomes the first blind Asian mountaineer to successfully scale the world's tallest peak, the Mount Everest. Zhang Hong completed the 8,849-meter high Himalayan feat with three high-altitude guides. The 46-year-old climber said he spent much of his trek holding onto his guide's arm. The pair said the most tiresome and risky areas were the so-called death zones, ice walls, and ice falls at around 8,000 meters. The Chinese climber recalled humbly embracing being part of Mother Nature after he completed his arduous journey.
No matter if you're disabled or normal, whether you have lost your eyesight or you have no legs or hands, it doesn't matter. As long as you have a strong mind, you can always complete anything that other people think you can't.
Zhang added that this is only the beginning. He said his next milestone is climbing the highest peaks from the world's continents known as the Seven Summits. The Chinese mountaineer lost his eyesight at the age of 21. After his success, he became the third visually impaired person to ever step foot on the Everest peak. A Russian company has developed a fully self-driving car that looks like it was taken right out of a sci-fi movie. Flip is the size of a conventional passenger car and has enough space for six people. Its creator says the advanced vehicle is a taxi of the future. Flip has fulfilled the requirements of international automated driving standards. It's powered by electricity, but it can also use other fuels like gas and hydrogen. The owners of this futuristic vehicle do not have to worry about running out of power. That's because its replaceable batteries can be changed in less than 5 minutes once they are out of electricity. A rare baby giraffe is born in a zoo in western France as conservationists try to increase the population of this endangered species. The cute Rothschild giraffe is the second born in a French zoo this year. Caretakers say the cubs will stay with the facility for 1 year before they would be sent to another site to start their own families. The Rothschild giraffes are critically endangered, and conservationists say that only 1,600 of them exist now. The general giraffe populations in the wild have also decreased by around 30% in the last three decades.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
For many professional climbers, ascending Mount Everest for even once remains an almost distant dream. However, a Nepali man has achieved that feat not once or twice, but 25 times. Kami Rita Sherpa has arrived back in the capital, Kathmandu, after breaking his own whopping record of 24 ascents to the summit of the world's tallest mountain. The veteran climber hopes that his accomplishment represents a big achievement for his small country. Climbing tall mountains runs in Kami's blood. He belongs to the Sherpa tribe, one of the Tibetan ethnic groups and native to the most mountainous region of Nepal.
Now, the iconic Eiffel Tower in Paris has been illuminated for the first time using electricity produced from certified renewable hydrogen. In an amazing show, hydrogen-generated lights were projected onto the tower's frames, displaying various patterns and designs, making viewers ecstatic. It's a dream project of a French company based in the city of Saint-Malo. The company wanted to make the most recognizable landmark a showcase for its carbon-free technology. The objective is to bring more awareness of renewable energy to the public. The nightly event will continue until May the 30th. Countries around the world are investing a lot to develop hydrogen-related technologies. A French musician helps patients in an end-of-life care home to escape from pain by playing the cello for them. Let's have a listen.
Music soothes pain as music eases their symptoms. In palliative care, in end-of-life care, there is sometimes still pain in spite of the morphine, in spite of the drugs that really help manage the pain of the patients. They still feel pain, and music really has a calming power on the residual pain of palliative care patients.
The sound of Claire Oppert's solo cello resonates through the rooms of Jean Garnier End-of-Life Care Home in southern Paris on Fridays. She plays for patients who suffer from physical pain as well as terminal illnesses. The center's staff say music lightens patients' moods and puts them in a calm state.
After Claire leaves the room, we find the patients in a calm state, at times moved, at times happy. A lot happens. There are moments of tears, moments of joy. When we go into the room, we find there is an encounter with the person and his or her story.
I'm in permanent pain. The music helps a little to escape from the pain, I think. You pay attention to the music, and if it's a piece you know, you anticipate the next note. There you go, it's like that.
Claire has been playing the cello for patients in end-of-life care for almost a decade. She says the fact that music makes people feel good has been known since the beginning of humanity, but today it needs to be proven scientifically. Therefore, she has made it her mission to demonstrate the therapeutic effects of music on patients by taking medical studies.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Guantanamo is and has always been a fraudulent operation with no real inclination to holding criminals and terrorists accountable and to preventing further crimes. Instead, Guantanamo is an industry and a lucrative one. In many ways, it is similar to the American prison military complex, ironically dubbed the criminal justice system, says Ramzi Barood, editor of Palestine Chronicle, in an article published under the heading, "The American Injustice Industry, Why Shutting Down Guantanamo is Not Enough." Stay tuned for the details, please. That's certainly our goal and our intention. This was the non-committal answer given by the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki when she was asked by a reporter whether the new Joe Biden administration intends to shut down the notorious Guantanamo Bay prison by the end of the president's first term in office. Saki's answer may have seemed reassuring, that the untold suffering experienced by hundreds of men in this American gulag, many of whom were surely innocent, would be finally coming to an end. However, considering the history of Guantanamo and the trail of broken promises by the Barack Obama administration, the new administration's pledge is hardly encouraging. Compare the new language with that of Obama's impassioned diatribes about humanity, justice, and American values, which he utilized whenever he spoke of Guantanamo. Gitmo has become a symbol around the world for an America that flouts the rule of law, Obama said at a speech at the National Defense University in May 2013. Enamored with his every word, Obama's audience clapped with enthusiasm. When he delivered that particular speech, Obama was then serving his second term in office. He already had ample opportunity to shut down the prison, which operated with no international monitoring and entirely outside the realms of international and U.S. laws. Obama is likely to be remembered for his words, not his actions. Not only did he fail to shut down the prison which was erected by his predecessor, George W. Bush, in 2002, but the Guantanamo industry continued to thrive during his terms. For example, in his speech, Obama made reference to the high cost of $150 million each year to imprison 166 people. According to the New Yorker reporting in 2016, Guantanamo's budget had morphed to $445 million last year when Obama was still in office. Yet, as the budget grew by leaps and bounds, the number of Guantanamo prisons dwindled. Currently, there are only 40 prisoners still residing in that massive edifice of metal, concrete, and barbed wire located at the eastern tip of Cuba, built atop a piece of land leased by the U.S. in 1903. It is easy to conclude that the U.S. government keeps the prison open only to avoid international accountability and arguably to extract information by torture, an act that is inconsistent with American laws. But this cannot be it. On the one hand, the entire wars against Afghanistan and Iraq were illegal under international law. Such a fact hardly stopped the U.S. and its allies from savagely invading, humiliating and torturing entire populations with no regard whatsoever to legal and moral arguments. On the other hand, Guantanamo is merely one of many American-run prisons and detention centers throughout the world that operate with no manual of rules and according to the most ruthless tactics. The tragedy of Abu Ghraib, a U.S. military detention center in Baghdad, only became famous when direct evidence of the degrading and incredibly violent conduct that was taking place within its walls was produced and publicized. In fact, many American officials and members of Congress at the time used the Abu Ghraib scandal in 2004 as an opportunity to whitewash and rebrand American crimes elsewhere and to present the misconduct in this Iraqi prison as if an isolated incident involving a few bad apples. The few bad apples arguments made by G.W. Bush was more or less the same logic utilized by Obama when he championed the closure of Guantanamo. Indeed, both presidents insisted that neither Abu Ghraib nor Guantanamo should be made out to represent what America is really all about. Is this who we are, Obama? Animatedly and passionately asked as he made a case in favor of the closure of Guantanamo, speaking as if a human rights advocate, not a commander-in-chief who had direct authority to shut down the entire facility. The truth is that Abu Ghraib tortures were not a few bad apples, and Guantanamo is indeed a microcosm of exactly what the U.S. is, or has become. from Bagram, Afghanistan to Abu Ghraib, Iraq to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba to the many floating prisons, news of which was leaked by U.S. media in 2014, the U.S. government continues to make a mockery of international and humanitarian laws. Many American officials who genuinely advocate the closure of Guantanamo refuse to acknowledge that the prison is a symbol of their country's intransigence and refuse to accept that, like any other country in the world, it is accountable to international law. This lack of accountability has exceeded the U.S. government's insistence to act alone, as in to launch wars without international mandates. One U.S. administration after another has also made it clear that under no circumstances would they allow accused war criminals to be investigated, let alone stand trial, before the International Criminal Court, ICC. The message here is that even America's bad apples can potentially walk free regardless of the heinousness of their crimes. Just months after the Trump administration imposed sanctions on the ICC judges to punish them for the potential investigations of U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan, it freed the convicted criminals who carried out horrific crimes in Iraq. On December 22nd, Trump pardoned four American mercenaries who belonged to the private military firm Blackwater. These convicted murderers were involved in the killing of 14 civilians, including two children, in Baghdad in 2007. What became known as the Nisour Square Massacre was another example of whitewashing, as government officials and mainstream media, though expressing outrage at the unlawful killing, insisted that the massacre was an isolated episode. The fact that hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, mostly civilians, were killed as a result of American invasion seems irrelevant in the country's skewed logic in its never-ending war on terror. Whether Biden fulfills his promise of shutting down Guantanamo or not, little will change if the U.S. remains committed to its condescending attitude towards international law and to its undeserved view of itself as a country that exists above the universal rights of everyone else. That said, Guantanamo on its own is a crime against humanity, and there can never be any justification to rationalize why hundreds of people are held indefinitely without trial, without due process, without international observers, and without ever seeing their families and loved ones. The explanation often offered by the pro-Guantanamo pundits is that the prison inmates are dangerous men. If that was indeed the case, why were these supposed criminals not allowed to see their day in court? According to a report by Amnesty International published in May 2020, of the 779 men who were taken to that facility, only seven have been convicted. Worse, five of them were convicted as a result of pretrial agreements under which they pleaded guilty in return for the possibility of release from the base. According to the rights group, such a trial by military commission did not meet fair trial standards. In other words, Guantanamo is and has always been a fraudulent operation with no real inclination to holding criminals and terrorists accountable and to preventing further crimes. Instead, Guantanamo is an industry and a lucrative one. In many ways, it is similar to the American prison military complex, ironically dubbed the criminal justice system. Referring to the unjust justice system, Human Rights Watch derided the U.S. for having the largest reported prison population in the world. HRW stated on its website, The U.S. criminal justice system, from policing and prosecution through to punishment, is plagued with injustices like racial disparities, excessively harsh sentencing, and drug and immigration policies that improperly emphasize criminalization. The above two can be considered an answer to Obama's rhetorical question. Is this who we are? Yes, Mr. Obama, in fact, this is precisely who you are. While offering the world's most miserable detention conditions to hundreds of potentially innocent men, Guantanamo also offers career opportunities, high military perks and honors, and a seemingly endless budget for a small army to guard only a few shackled, gaunt-looking men in a faraway land. So even if Biden is able to overcome pressure from the military, from the CIA, and from Congress to shut Guantanamo down, justice will still be absent, not only because of the numerous lives that are forever shattered, but because America still refuses to learn from its mistakes.
Ministry.
Photos of the martyrs and the cries of families from under the rubble of their homes are ceaseless. Children the age of mine hiding behind their parents, their only remaining safe place, chanting a surah from the Holy Quran, hoping from the Lord of Heaven to escape death. As for the hospitals, their corridors turned into hell with the arrival of the martyrs and the wounded in dozens of batches. A paramedic comes out screaming as he just found the bodies of his two younger brothers lying in the fridge. A father at the emergency gate embraces his infant son, the last survivor of his entire family. "May our Lord give us patience, Yaba," he says to his wounded little child, collapsing in tears. As for the little boy who joined the procession of his martyr father screaming during the funeral, his voice will continue to haunt this world forever. The number of martyrs is rising insanely inside Gaza, with 174 as of Sunday and more than 1,400 wounded. These included 39 children and 22 women since the start of the Israeli aggression last week. Retaliating to Israel's fiery winter and its targeting of children, women, and residential buildings, Israel finds itself surrounded by missiles that have reached deep into the occupied territories, in an equation perpetuated by the resistance. Every residential building that is bombed in Gaza will be met by bombing Tel Aviv and the internal occupied territories inhabited by illegal colonial settlers. In the context, the military spokesman for the Al-Qassam Brigades, Abu Ubaidah, confirmed, saying, "We have prepared ourselves to bomb Tel Aviv for 6 continuous months in retaliation to Israel's incremental genocide." The Palestinian people do not expect a lesson from anyone on how to resist the occupation. Today, they are teaching us how they deal with frustration, fatigue, and blockade. And they explain, for those who want to understand, that when there is a will to confront the aggressor, a lot can be achieved. What we are witnessing in terms of military capabilities in Gaza is nothing but the result of years of hard work, with a heavy price paid in sweat, blood, and tears. It paid off, though. And be not faint of heart when you seek out the enemy. If you happen to suffer pain, behold, they are also suffering as you suffer. Welcome to the Mideast Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The Israeli occupation continues to intensify its aggression to pressure the Palestinian resistance in the Gaza Strip through a series of intense air raids unparalleled in the history of Gaza's struggle with the occupation. In the wake of the painful strikes from the resistance, the occupation lost all sanity, carrying out scores of airstrikes on Gaza with F-16 and F-35 war jets, dropping more than 500 heavy missiles at various targets in the strip on residential areas, media towers, and crossroads, leading to scores of martyrs and injured civilians. To discuss this issue with us from Minnesota is Manar Adli, founder of MinPress News, producer and host of Behind the Headline. Thank you very much for being with us, Manar. Now, the fighting round has intensified between the occupation and the Palestinian resistance inside of the Gaza Strip, as well inside the interior occupied territories. But while the operation is dubbed Al-Quds Sword inside of Gaza, it is passing on steadily with various surprises against their enemy. The latter returns to its masters, genocide, killing civilians, bombing residential areas. This time, not only just residential towers are being wiped out, but entire residential squares, I mean, entire neighborhoods are being flattened down. This is the definition of ethnic cleansing, of genocide. Will resistance retaliation be enough to stop this genocide?
Well, as you described, Mauro, we are witnessing a massacre, an unprecedented massacre and genocide, basically being broadcasted live for the world to witness. And yet Israel continues to face absolutely no consequences. The United States has, Joe Biden, we call him Sleepy Joe Biden, he basically gave just a one-minute response about this massacre that has left over 200 civilians dead, including over 50 children now. That makes up over 40% of the deaths to include children. And so Joe Biden simply came out to say that Israel has a right to defend itself. Defend itself against who? These children? That's who the mainstream corporate media is describing as the militants that Israel has a right to defend itself to. And so because of the gravity of this massacre, because entire families, as you described, are being completely wiped off of the map, we're seeing images of, just a baby being rescued from the rubble, whereas the mother, the father, the siblings, the uncles, the aunts, the grandmas, the grandfathers are completely, they've died. They've died in these massacres from Israeli bombs being hit. And so the people of Palestine, and especially in Gaza, are, their blood is boiling. And they have a lot of hope to continue to fight Israel and retaliate and respond through their resistance. Under international law, Palestinians have the right to defend themselves.
Wars can be triggered by an isolated incident, but their cause is always deeper than that. In this case, the trigger was the what's being called upon as an eviction, but it's stealing the land and the homes of the Palestinians in favor for Israeli illegal colonial settlers, especially in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in East Al-Quds. This is what started it, including the attack on Al-Aqsa Mosque, one of Islam's holiest sites. Why did this sudden eruption of war outside and inside Israel's occupation borders come as such a shock for apartheid Israel?
Well, I think talking about the timeline is really important. We have to break down really how this conflict got started. Obviously, outside of the context that this most recent eruption of violence erupted during the month of Ramadan and Eid, where images of Israeli forces and police were basically pulling Palestinians out of their homes in Sheikh Jarrah, who are basically resisting settlers, Israeli colonial settlers that are coming from New York with Brooklyn accents that want to come and expel these Palestinians from their homes, claiming that they have a heritage there, 2,000 years there, when in reality these are the Palestinians that have lived in these homes for decades, centuries, and have a historical tie to these homes. Mm-hmm. And so it's really important to understand that this is outside of just what has happened in the last week or two. This is about a broader issue of Israeli occupation and ethnic cleansing and genocide that has been taking place for over 75 years now. And the world over is witnessing this ethnic cleansing take place on live TV, and the Palestinian youth are banding together and are basically leading this revolution.
what really pushes my buttons is that the plight of the Palestinian people is always dealt with in a discrimination fashion, discriminatory contempt from the Western regime, from the Western governments in specific, even at the humanitarian level. Why do you think that is happening?
Well, Israel has such a stronghold when it comes to, you know, the world political scene. They have historically been threatening the UN. They have been threatening the ICC that has been trying to hold Israel accountable for war crimes. The Israel lobby is extremely, extremely powerful in the United States, you know, funding U.S. politicians to silence them and to get silence them about the Palestinian cause and to get them to attack and smear Palestinian voices. You know, I was just watching a video last night of a former Israeli minister. I don't remember what her name was, but she was discussing how, you know, anytime Palestinians speak up and revolt, all Israel has to do is use the words anti-Semitism.
Wow.
And use, and she was admitting to this. She said that all we have to do is use the words, the accusation, the label anti-Semitism, and it silences the world over and brings people back to support Israel. Anti-Semitism has been weaponized to silence the Palestinian people, but unfortunately what anti-Semitism, the accusation of anti-Semitism has done is actually increased anti-Semitism against Jews the world over. But that's not the point. The point is that the Israel lobby and the power of the Israel war machine is so powerful that it has now brought in also not just, you know, the EU and other Western countries, but it is now brought in through the help of course, Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, peace deals and arms deals between Israel and Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Morocco, and Sudan. And so Israel is power and influence is now the world over. And so that's why we're seeing even these very lame condemnations coming out of Saudi Arabia and Egypt saying, you know, we condemn Israel. But in reality, they are completely complicit in the crimes that Israel is committing against Palestinians because they are working hand in hand with Israel, not only in Gaza and Palestine to silence and massacre the Palestinian people, but to silence, to starve and massacre the people in Yemen. Mm-hmm. And so when Joe Biden comes out and says that we're working with our allies in the region, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Egypt, to work with Israel, you know, to find a solution, all Joe Biden is saying is that we as the mass murderers, the U.S. empire, the largest empire the world has ever seen that spreads terror across the world and bloodshed, we are turning to other mass murderers like Saudi Arabia, who's committing a major genocide in Israel, in Yemen, excuse me, for advice on how to solve this issue. So as long as U.S. imperialism and its proxies reign freely, there will be no justice in Palestine.
Well, it remains to be seen how the internal resistance and the Gaza resistance will work together further in harmony to try and protect Palestine and lead the way for the freedom of Palestine. I want to thank you very much, Manar Adli, founder of Min Press News and producer and host of Behind the Headline, for being with us to discuss this plight against the entire nation of Palestine. Thank you for being with us. Please stay tuned. Next, we will talk about how the resistance was able to show the failure of the Israeli intelligence.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts.
One of the most important features of the confrontation waged by the resistance factions in the Gaza Strip against the Israeli attacks is that it has been characterized by a series of surprises that establish new equations that will have a profound impact on the perception of the Israeli regime's political and security institutions towards Gaza when it comes to future rules of engagement. Now, the series of surprises began with the involvement of the resistance inside Gaza directly with the Al-Quds line of events, when they issued a warning to the occupation authorities to backtrack on their Judaization attempts and repressive measures against Jerusalemites, or else things will get ugly for the occupation, and indeed they did. More details in this following report.
The starting point in the response to the Zionist Israeli aggression is that the heroics recorded by the Palestinian resistance dropped the false assessments that were repeated by the Israeli intelligence apparatus, claiming the Palestinians are far from initiating an effective and painful response in the internal Israeli settlements. The series of surprises began with the entry of Hamas and the rest of the resistance factions directly on the Al-Quds line, when they issued a warning to the occupation authorities to backtrack on their Judaization and repressive measures against Jerusalemites. The events that followed were foundational and unprecedented, as they established a new equation of deterrence inside the Palestinian territories, which Tel Aviv fears its consequences and repercussions on the entire Palestinian scene. In this position, the resistance all across Palestine was able to reconnect what was broken by the flimsy Oslo Agreement. Nevertheless, the Israeli military and intelligence minds were not ready to realize that a second shocking surprise awaited them. They did not ask the settlers gathered in Jerusalem to leave, despite the warning of the Qassam brigades. Rather, it seems that they were presuming that the limit was to launch a few rockets at the settlements surrounding the Gaza enclave. However, the first retaliatory attack from Gaza reached occupied Jerusalem, leading to utmost panic among the settlers, who were seen fleeing in every direction. The next surprise was presented by the large and synchronous missile salvos that were able to bypass Israel's missile interception system, as well as the accuracy of the hit from the first thrash, which reflected the improvement in aiming and guidance due to the technological development that the resistance had developed. The volume of the simultaneous missile strikes reveals the fact that the size of the missile stockpile is much greater than the Israeli estimations, and the tactics adopted by the resistance showed a serious Israeli intelligence failure, as this constitutes the basis of any recommendation of military operational options, as well as failure in assessing the hostile capabilities of Israel on its southern front line with Gaza. Thus, instead of the continued Israeli attacks improving the occupation forces' image and restoring prestige, the missile retaliation deepened the leadership crisis in Tel Aviv and constituted a challenge that it could not overcome, leading it to target high residential and media towers in the Gaza Strip, hoping to deter any resistance through genocidal tactics. Here came the next resounding surprise by targeting occupied Tel Aviv and its environs through Qassam brigades and Al-Quds brigades, with dozens of missiles that were also able to bypass Israel's missile interception system and achieve accurate hits. This led to a completely new scene for Israel, where it realized that it was up to its neck in a quagmire that had not even crossed the minds of its incompetent leaders.
Now with us from Beirut is Sharmeen Narwani, independent journalist and political commentator, to talk about to us about how the Gaza resistance was able to show the world that Israel is just not that tough. Sharmeen, the series of surprises began with the entry of Hamas and the rest of the resistance factions in the Gaza Strip directly on the Al-Quds events, the events of Sheikh Jarrah and Al-Aqsa Mosque. This was a first surprise that that the Israelis could not really understand and fathom, as it was unprecedented. Now, was the resistance in Gaza able to establish a new maybe equation of deterrence that will have repercussions on the entire Palestinian scene, even outside of the Gaza Strip?
To be honest, my opinion is no, not yet. There are two components of deterrence, the way I look at it, for in this particular situation. One is the military deterrence, and that has not been established yet. We can talk about that a bit later. Mm-hmm. But what is, I think, really critical to note, and I think many people have noted, is this insurrection has been very different than in the past, when Gaza has gone at it alone. So from Jerusalem to the West Bank, to very unusually Palestinians inside Israel, who are Israeli citizens, and then Gaza, have all combined their forces. And this is important because Israel has assiduously spent decades trying to separate these Palestinian units. And in one shot, after the events at Al-Aqsa Mosque, they all combined. So in terms of future militaristic adventures for Israel, I think they will be very hesitant. So I think in that sense, there has been a new deterrence mark set, not militarily yet, but certainly in terms of breaking all of the taboos Israel had helped work to establish very hard about Palestinians uniting on one front.
Well, the next surprise was presented by the large and synchronous missile salvos that were able to bypass Israel's Iron Dome, showcasing the technological advancement that the resistance has developed. And Israel has shown that its top-notch anti-missile system, its defense system, has failed. So if that is the case, how about if they go on a ground invasion towards Gaza? What will happen then?
Well, firstly, like I said earlier, I do not think Palestinians have established military deterrence yet. Mm-hmm. And it's because, so the Israelis claimed yesterday, I think by yesterday, in a UN report, that there were 2,900 missiles fired from Gaza into Israel. According to the United Nations, 450 bypassed the Iron Dome. And some of those fell in Gaza. But a lot of them reached commercial targets, residential targets, and very essentially, as the Israelis believe, that Palestinians in Gaza are now trying to target Israel's energy sector. They closed the Tamar gas field. Mm-hmm. Because there were drones, Palestinian drones and rockets fired towards it, and Palestinians also fired rockets towards a crude oil pipeline in Israel. So the central thing here is for us, don't forget, Palestinians have promised more surprises, much like Hezbollah did in 2006. So we haven't quite seen those yet. We have seen some targeted missiles, but they need to have very accurate, pinpointed, targeted missiles for this to become a major deterrence to the state of Israel.
Well,
and anti-aircraft missiles, for that matter. I mean, if we see one of those, it's game over for the Israeli Air Force to a certain extent. As for your question about will we see a land attack by Israel, I do not think that makes any sense for the Israelis. They will clock a lot more soldier deaths and possibly kidnappings, which is a worst-case scenario for Israel. They don't go into Gaza, as we've seen in the past, in a light way. They go in heavy with these soldiers burdened down with equipment. They go with armored vehicles and aircraft above. So it will be a very, very hard play for Israel. I don't see them doing a land invasion anytime soon.
Well, the tactics adopted by the resistance showed a serious Israeli intelligence failure, as the intel usually constitutes the basis of any recommendation for a military maneuver or a military operational option. How on earth did Israel fail to the extent that in assessing the anti-Israeli capabilities in its southern front alone, which I'm not saying that it's not enough, but compared to other fronts, it should have assessed it in a better way?
We've seen that Israel isn't very good at this, contrary to sort of popular impressions. We saw this in 2006, and the Israelis had the Winograd Commission, which they saw very clearly outlined that the state had failed miserably in its intelligence activities leading up to this confrontation. And so why would this be any different? I think the Israelis are very soft in some ways now. They've sort of cruised in cruise control for years, banking on endless American billions and state-of-the-art American military equipment, believing in some way that a qualitative military edge had ensured that Arab states around it would not attack Israel. But this is different. This is from within. So I don't see, Israel continues to have blind spots. Mm-hmm. And if I were Israel, I would be looking at what the Houthis and Ansarallah were able to do with pinpoint targeting of missiles at Aramco to understand what Gaza potentially has up its sleeve.
Mm-hmm. Well, apartheid, Israel already knows that this confrontation will have its toll on its regional image in particular, especially with those that they have openly became friends with, especially when their limited capabilities against Gaza were exposed, as you mentioned earlier. Massive questions now are being raised concerning the possible encounter against Hezbollah on the northern front, which enjoys vastly different weaponry and objective advantages. We have seen that in Syria over the past 11 years. After what we have seen in Gaza and the occupied Palestinian territories as well, how do you assess the Israeli position in the event of a confrontation, at least, not to say a war, with Hezbollah on the northern front?
I don't think Israel will be picking bones with Hezbollah right now. It's barely managing to stay on control of the situation in Gaza and the other occupied territories and inside Israel. We have to look at this. Like, Israel canceled its largest ever military exercise just because of some skirmishes in Jerusalem. You know, Hezbollah manages Lebanon's borders, keeping them secure. It fights in Syria. It fights in Iraq. It doesn't cancel a major military exercise because of something that happens in one city. Mm-hmm. So is Israel prepared? No, they're not. They have zero strategic depth, and they have foes on at least three borders that are willing and able to lob missiles at them. From Syria, from Lebanon, and from Gaza. So, as Israel becomes more desperate, one doesn't know what they're going to do, but whether it's a land war or attacking another country in the region, it would be absolutely suicide for Israel.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Hermine Irwani, independent journalist and political commentator, for joining us on this program. Thank you for being here. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
The limelight.
while the attention of the world is turned towards Palestine, Yemen, and other hot spots in West Asia, the repressive minority regime of the Persian Gulf island state of Bahrain ruthlessly continues its brutalities against the Bahraini people. This situation is alarming in a police state that deprives citizens of all civil liberties, even confiscating the nationalities of people whose forefathers have been living in Bahrain for several centuries, long before the Al Khalifa pirates seized Bahrain 2 centuries ago. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Kahan International. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Support Emboldens Bahraini Regime to Commit More Crimes. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. When the attention of the world is turned towards Palestine, Yemen, and other hot spots in West Asia, the repressive minority regime of the Persian Gulf island state of Bahrain ruthlessly continues its brutalities against the Bahraini people. There were reports earlier this month of the prison guards of the Al Khalifa regime breaking up protest gatherings of the political inmates with cruel measures that even irked Godfather U.S. Then, there are reports from London of the links between Home Secretary Priti Patel and one of the chief tormentors of the people of Bahrain, Interior Minister Rashid Ben Abdullah Al Khalifa. Added to these violations of human rights and the insults to the oppressed Bahraini people are the recent comments of the British ambassador in Manama, Roderick Drummond, that the prisons in Bahrain are well-run facilities with good medical provision. He shamelessly likened these torture chambers to 5-star hotels when the whole world knows the worsening plight of the thousands of men, women, and even children detained by the regime and deprived of even basic facilities. The May 25th meeting between Patel and General Rashid has angered people across the spectrum in the UK that she is whitewashing abuse. A human rights worker said, "It is so disturbing to see the UK government advertising its partnership with Bahrain like this, when it knows full well that the regime systematically uses torture and death sentences to suppress dissent." Sayed Ahmad Al-Wada'i, director of the human rights group Bahrain Institute for Rights and Democracy, BIRD, said the encounter showed the UK was willing to ignore human rights abuses as long as they are committed by allied states. "It is nothing but hypocrisy on the part of both London and Washington to continue their support for the repressive Al Khalifa minority regime, which has been condemned by the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights as a violation of international law. The torture chambers in Bahrain, like that of the Zionist regime, have children as young as 13 years who are regularly beaten and threatened with rape. Yet the West likes to look the other way." "The situation is alarming in a police state that deprives citizens of all civil liberties, even confiscating the nationalities of people whose forefathers have been living in Bahrain for several centuries, long before the Al Khalifa pirates seized Bahrain 2 centuries ago. The leader of the people of Bahrain, Sheikh Isa Qasim, has been forced into exile, while prisoners are executed at will on veer charges. All these developments mean the patience of the Bahraini people is running thin, and the hitherto peaceful protests